Hi, everyone. This is Steve Lemmy.
Hey, it's Kevin Heffernan. How's it going? We got a great, great, great show today.
Do you think it's the best one we've ever done?
It's really good. Good guest, good time, good laughs. On the show is James Rodet.
Who's that?
You know him from Psych.
Okay.
The star of Psych.
Okay.
He also, you know, did some writing on that show, directing on that show.
Okay.
You also maybe know him from The Dukes of Hazzard,
okay,
a movie that we worked on together.
Okay.
And
okay,
you may know him from Beer Fest.
Oh, that's how I know him.
There you go. Boom.
Okay. He was great in Beer Fest.
He was great in Beer Fest. But I think, you know, his claim to fame is Psych. I mean, that people love that show.
It's
a great show.
It's a funny show. It's one of those shows that has just grown and grown in popularity each season, and has now reached cult status.
Yeah. And we talked a lot about it. We got some good insight into making that show. So
yeah, we talked.
Listen to it. You'll like it.
Life, love, and entertainment.
Yeah. Let's do our sponsor.
I don't want to today, Kev.
What are you talking about?
Okay, I'll do it.
The good people at K1?
Okay. I thought you meant the other sponsor.
Oh.
C4.
Yeah. J2?
Yeah. But K1, when you say K1...
Then it makes you want to do it.
Yeah, it makes me feel good because they're our friends.
They are our friends.
Over at K1 Speed.
That's right.
And if you have the need for speed, K1 Speed is the place to race.
K1 Speed is America's premier indoor kart racing center in the United States of America.
What can you do there, Kev?
You can experience the thrills of 100% emissions-free European-style electric go-karts.
European-style, like the movie Rush?
Yeah, like Grand Prix.
Okay.
Grand Prix.
Well, if Thor is going to be driving with
sure.
me, then I'm sure we will be able to reach speeds of 45 miles per hour. High-speed thrills for adults and juniors.
Huh. Race on over to a location near you.
Where?
K1 Speed.
Okay. 7 days a week, and you can fulfill your need for speed. And if you haven't experienced the thrills of racing at K1 Speed, do yourself a favor and find a location near you. Oh, you said that already.
I did. You go to K1Speed.com. They'll tell you all the locations. And then you can also hop on the TuneIt website and download a coupon. There's a coupon over there.
A coupon, like what kind of coupon? To save money?
Yeah, oh yeah.
On what? On my next racing experience?
Yeah, on your next racing experience.
Okay.
At K1 Speed.
Okay. K1 Speed. K?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. Okay, one?
K?
Good. Let's plug our own stuff, though. This weekend, mm-hmm. we're going to be in Dayton, Ohio.
What are the dates, Kev?
We will be performing January 24th and 25th.
How many shows... And
two,
where?
Two on Friday, two on Saturday.
And what's the name of the location?
The Funny Bone. The Dayton Funny Bone. I always have a good time with those Funny Bones.
They're funny places.
Yeah, they always seem to be packed and fun and E and bony.
That's a good one.
I don't know.
No, you
that's
nailed
the kind
it.
Of stuff people can expect, right?
You nailed it. Kevin, everyone knows you're the funny one.
Thank
I don't
you.
Even know why I bother.
It's because I have a good funny bone.
Come
Thank
on.
You very much. Okay, so come out this weekend, Dayton. All you people Dayton around Dayton, you're in Columbus, you're in Cincinnati, you're in Indianapolis, drive over to Dayton.
You know what? I'm going to say this. Fuck it. You're in the next state over.
Yeah, come on over.
There's a lot of states. Even if you're in Canada, come on down.
Yeah, Friday and Saturday night, January 24th and 25th. And then next weekend, we are going to be up at the San Francisco Sketch Fest. And I've never been. You've never been. I hear it's a great thing.
Well, I already love San Francisco, and
yeah.
I love sketches. And so these
yeah.
are two great tastes that taste great together.
And there's tons of shows, tons of comics up there. And we are going to do a live podcast
mm-hmm.
of Chewing It at the Punchline in San Francisco on Saturday afternoon, February 1st.
That's where we shot our comedy special, Fat Man Little Boy, available on Netflix to stream now.
So come over there February 1st. At 4:30 or 4 o'clock, something like that. You go to their website. You go to our website, heffernanlemmy.com. All the info's there. You can come to a live taping of Chewing It. We're gonna have some guests.
Yeah.
We're gonna have some fun. We're gonna have some laughs.
Yeah, we have a Club Dread guest showing up.
I think we're gonna do a Club Dread guest.
Yeah,
yeah.
And we might have another few local guests. Yeah. But wait a second, is that all we're doing in San
no.
Francisco?
No, that night we will be doing a screening of Super Troopers, and we'll do a Q&A. I think we're gonna do the Q&A before the screening.
It's an odd. We're doing. It's called a European film screening.
Yeah,
like European doubles.
The Q&A early. It's
Wait,
at the Roxy
oh,
Theater.
It's Canadian doubles. What's wrong with me?
I don't know.
It's Canadian screening. Q&A first, then the movie.
Yeah.
At the Roxy Theater.
At the Roxy Theater that night, like 10 o'clock, I think, on February 1st, and I think that's almost sold out. So if you want to go, get your tickets.
Yeah.
So go to heffernanlemmy.com. You can get tickets, or you can go to like the San Francisco Sketch Fest website, and they'll have their information there. But yeah, if you're in San Francisco. come see the podcast that afternoon and then come to the screen that night.
Yeah, if you are in San Francisco.
Then the next weekend.
If you need something, if you're in San Francisco and you want to drown your sorrows.
Drown your sorrows. What about Have Some Laughs?
49ers.
Oh.
If you want to put a smile on your face. Katie Levine, our producer, is from San Francisco. She's giving me the stink eye now.
All right. Then the next weekend, we're at Cuse.
Cuse, baby, Cuse.
Back up to our old stomping ground.
Mm-hmm. Central New York, CNY.
CNY. We're going to be at Cuse at the Funny Bone up there February 7th and 8th.
Dude, we own the Funny Bone.
I know. We really do. February 7th and 8th, Friday and Saturday nights up in Cuse.
Two shows each night.
Yeah, yeah. Come see us. Come say hi. We'll have a beer.
In your special CNY way.
Get out of the cold.
Yeah, hey there. Thanks for coming up to Syracuse.
That's pretty good.
Was that not bad,
yeah,
right?
That's good. All right, so that's all the info that we need. Let's get to this episode because it's a good one.
Dude, James Rodet.
James Rodet.
Chewing it.
I think you're going to like it.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Chew it
with a guy named Kevin.
Chew it
and this other guy Steve.
Chew it
from the TV and the movies and now this podcast stream.
Chew it,
they're gonna get chewy.
Chew it,
they might even get me.
Chew it,
but they're gonna get funky on this podcast thing.
Let's chew before we get too far here. Our podcast is called Chewing It. We like to chew. What is it?
What is that?
What are you chewing, man?
I don't know. I feel like you guys have much more sophisticated palates than I do.
Tell me, what
am I eating here?
I can't even hear you chewing.
I think you're eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Is that what that
it
is?
It is. It's either tuna fish or PBJ.
Because was nostalgia involved. I knew that. I didn't want to embarrass myself by coming out with something that was just way left of center. But
what would be left of center?
Fagois. I thought maybe you guys are trying to throw me for a loop.
No,
I had plenty of PBJs in my time. That makes sense. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you got it. I hope it was delicious.
It was.
Now, do you guys shoot up in Vancouver?
We did. For 8 glorious years, we spent more than half of our time as humans in beautiful Vancouver.
The Coove?
Yeah.
Why do you have Vancouver issues?
Well, no, so I'm just wondering if living up there, your seafood palate became expanded.
Here's a strange fact.
Factoid?
I went to Vancouver fully expecting, and
dudes.
I had a great time working in Vancouver.
Sure.
I love the city. I love the people. I think it just destroys shooting an episodic series in L.A., which is kind of a nightmare.
Yeah.
So it was actually a really great place to work. But I went up there assuming, because it's surrounded by water, that I was going to have the best sushi and seafood, for that matter,
in the world
that I had ever had.
Yeah.
And I have to say, L.A. sushi is better than Vancouver sushi.
Okay.
Really?
Weird.
But really?
True.
What about, I'm really sort of getting at like the oysters and the crab specifically.
Not a huge oyster guy.
Okay.
Anything you have to douse with that much like additional flavoring to make, to justify eating it, I don't really.
Salad.
You don't have to.
Salad.
Eat it raw.
Do you not like
up a loogie and swallow it back down.
I know. That's what I think oysters are.
Have to go anywhere.
I know.
Dude,
that's what I think oysters are.
You have just offended a lot of oyster lovers.
Whatever.
Comparing oysters.
Fuck them. They can fuck themselves.
I'm one of them.
Oh, fuck you.
Fuck you too. But what about salad then? Do you not like salad?
I enjoy a nice salad.
What do you mean? What do you mean salad?
Well, because salad is also something you have to dress up with a lot of shit to make it good.
Oh, I say how so.
I guess, but there's some nutritional value there, maybe. Okay. I do like vegetables, though, man. I just do.
Can I call a timeout here for a second?
I wish you would.
Because you're, as always, you're already on my nerves.
I don't think I haven't done anything.
No, it's because I've realized something. I was thinking about this after the podcast we did with Eric and Paul.
Yeah.
What I had enjoyed your company all that day. We had driven together. I had been at your house.
Yeah.
We had worked together,
mm-hmm.
and you hadn't gotten on my nerves. And it was 5 minutes in. Like, you have this different attitude. It's like
I
this.
I think
like,
you have a different attitude.
No, it's your drinking Irishman thing. Like where
That's
you get
what
all
we do.
Aggressive.
You have, I don't
you suggesting
I
that Kev has like a pod personality.
I am,
but he does too.
I am. I'm just being myself.
Okay.
I'm just talking.
All right, well, let's try to get past it. We didn't even introduce the guy yet.
Okay.
Didn't even introduce him yet.
Okay, so for those people who don't know, we have a very special guest here today.
An old friend.
An old dear friend.
Mm-hmm.
Will you guys introduce me as Lawrence Hilton Jacobs?
Sure.
Yeah.
Do it.
Our good friend, Larry Hilton Jacobs.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much. Larry? Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah. See? It's always good to have Larry here.
L.H. Good old L.H.
James Rhode.
It's me.
Rhode.
James Rhode.
You're looking fucking good.
He's looking cut, dude.
Thanks, guys.
You look buff. Are you
look
training
like
or something?
Construction.
You know what?
MMA? You doing MMA?
I'm doing some light MMA.
Okay.
That's where you don't actually compete or fight anyone.
Okay.
But you wear the gear.
Okay.
And you go near the gym.
Okay.
Well, no, I've had a little free time for the first time in a long time. And
nice.
What you realize is that you completely run out of excuses to not be in shape when you have free time.
It's no bullshit.
Yeah. So you kind of have to do
it. So he's looking, that's why he's looking so cut.
Yeah. The only reason.
Like, yeah, like if I didn't know you,
yeah,
and I walked in here and Kevin introduced you as James Rhode, his friend from Major League Baseball, I would buy it
right from the Mariners.
Wow,
yeah, perhaps
James Rhode,
because he like right now with the hairdo, with the tough hairdo and the full beard,
yeah,
and the you're peacocking with some earrings going,
yeah, definitely peacocking,
yeah, yeah.
There's no question about that,
and the thickness, like yeah. you've
the
got
thickness
the thickness
of his chest.
He's got the thickness of a Major League Baseball.
Well,
player.
He's a ball player, you know that.
Well, listen, man,
I do. I played baseball or softball with him.
Yeah,
and that was epic.
Yeah,
and the scoreboard always backed that up.
Do you know that? Do you know that we wound up winning two championships?
Are you kidding me?
No,
the season after you left.
Oh, congratulations!
We won two
guys.
Championships in a row.
That was the kiss of death. You didn't.
You
need
weren't
me.
Though. You
no,
weren't.
You just needed.
It was more like Chandrasekhar.
You know, I broke my thumb playing with you guys.
You did?
I broke a bone playing
what,
with you guys.
What happened? When was that? Did we know, or did you like?
No,
you like
I sucked it up.
Rub dirt in it.
He toughed it out.
I broke it. I played the rest of that game. I went and got it splinted, and then I think I was done. But
what, like, you seriously? Like, what did you like? Fall on it? Or something?
I dug a ball out at first base. Don't ask me why I was playing first base, but you guys threw me over there. And
I thought I played first base, right?
It was like one inning.
Fuck. Oh no! Maybe back then,
because I was usually, you know, in the outfield. That's
a ringer. He was a ringer.
Yeah. I thought you played shortstop.
I started at short
because I remember you made a nice stab on a ground ball.
And then I got moved around. I was sort of like wherever you guys need me. And then for some reason, I ended up at first, and it was like a one hopper coming from third or something. and I dug it out, but my thumb went straight into the earth.
Oh man!
Yeah,
sorry,
broke. For you guys, I did that.
But yeah, I didn't even feel like that. I got to say thank you because you didn't tell us.
And it was an 8-0 because we lost that game.
We lost big time.
And
we were undefeated.
Many games after that.
But it wasn't because of you, though, because you were, I think, at a level of play a little higher than, say, me.
But I was rusty, and we didn't come together as a team, and I feel like that's, you know, we're all to blame for that.
But if you were with us the next season, you would have been part of coming together as
a team.
That
would have felt great.
It had nothing to do with you.
The piece that fell into place was I felt that we got a good catcher. We moved Phil Cotone to catcher because catcher had always been where we put like the worst players.
Sure. It's softball,
but you realize that a lot of things were happening behind the plate.
Plays at the plate. Oh, right.
Things like that.
Yeah.
And he was able to catch the ball, which is something none of our catchers had been able to do.
Did you move on to like a better softball team? Is that what happened?
No, that pretty much ended
the
my run.
The psych softball team?
Yeah, Dulé Hill invited him to play for his
come
softball
play for
team.
His softball
you
team.
Know what? I had played intense like competitive softball for like years before
I played
with you guys. I played in a Brentwood league for 7 years.
That's big time Brentwood league.
Huge. And then I played in a Cheviot Hills league.
Oh, okay. Like, well, so did we.
Wasn't that our league?
You played in the higher level league.
I did. We ended up winning like a city championship that was kind of like...
Wow.
As much as you can achieve playing recreational men's softball, we did that. And to me, I felt like that's how I should... I mean, I should Elway that shit, right? I should
sure.
call it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was kind of my plan to hang up the cleats after that. But then, you know, you guys wanted me to come out.
And come so back out again.
I dusted it off. It wasn't the same.
You figured it would be easy, though. It's like...
Skill set wasn't there. My heart, I think, was dodgy and patchy.
And then you broke your thumb.
Then I broke my thumb and it was like, fuck you guys.
And that's why we haven't spoken to you since then.
Exactly.
Because that's the last time I saw you was on the softball field.
No, that's...
I have a good story the last time I saw him.
Give it to me.
Okay. Do we do enough intro for James Rhode? Can I go into the story now?
Do whatever you want.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know. You know, James Rhode, right? Actor, director,
actually,
producer.
I came in here. I walked in cranky.
Oh, you did? You had a bad drive?
I did. Yeah, the drive was shit.
Did you have to drive far, Rhode?
No, not bad at all.
Okay. Okay, not too far from where you live.
East Sider, sure.
You know, actually, I was reading some stuff about you, Rhode.
Yeah?
Even though we've known each other.
We have.
I felt like I needed to know a little more.
Mm-hmm.
You guys have a very similar trait.
Lemmy and I.
Yeah. Which I think someone meeting you wouldn't necessarily know when they met you, is that you both have Hispanic fathers. Do you have an Hispanic father?
That is absolutely true.
And you have an Hispanic father?
I do have
it. Like, you have a thick accented father. Does your father have an accent or no?
He does not. In, if anything, he has like a southern fried, a little bit of a twang.
So is he second generation? Who is the first? Who
is it
the
okay
last?
To talk about this?
Of course.
Okay, good.
Of course.
What do you think? He's hiding a secret?
Well, I don't know. Some people don't like to talk about their families.
You think just because I changed my name, I don't want to talk about my
no,
heritage?
No, no. I think some people get a little bit like, let's not talk about my family. But
no,
I'm not.
It'd be sweet if Rodé walked out right now.
I know,
now
if he dropped the mic and walked. Yeah,
go viral.
My father is third generation Mexicans in Texas.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so he's not, he doesn't speak Spanish?
He does.
Okay.
He does. My father and all of his brothers and sisters all speak Spanish. It was my generation where the Spanish speaking kind of went to shit.
So you can't speak Spanish?
I am very bad. You know, I was fluent when I was a kid, and I should have kept it up. But, you know, as a child,
you same with you.
Yeah, but when you say very bad, it's relative because, like, I say I'm very bad, but I'm comparing it to when I go to Argentina and try to communicate with my family. They have to slow it down for me.
Yeah,
but here I can speak
slow
to everyone.
Then you get a leg up on me, and okay. I like the way that leg looks.
It's looking good. It's looking.
That's
good.
A hot looking leg.
I won a best legs contest in high school.
Yes, you did. Yeah,
that's weird because you don't have a calf.
It was fixed.
I remember thinking. I remember your legs in Club Dread, and I remember being slightly uncomfortable because of the
but
way
how
that
did
I
they look?
Yeah, because of the way I felt about them.
It was
yeah.
all fake though, because he doesn't have a calf because of he had a polio issue as a kid.
Yeah,
and so he has just a bone
in one leg,
and it's fucked.
The other leg is Reg. One leg is Reg, one leg is Diesel.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So what did you do to create the, you know, the illusion?
The illusion of good-looking legs? Tan. Tans. Tans are
very impressed. Yeah, I wore black.
Very impressed.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So let's talk Spanish. So you don't, are you conversational in Spanish?
Not really. Like, I would hate to have to get any kind of important information to save someone's life out of a Spanish speaker.
Okay. What about the holidays? Like, do you celebrate Cinco de Mayo?
I'm generally aware that Cinco de Mayo is more than just the 5th of May.
You know what, though? It's so funny because it's like, as I said it, like a natural smirk comes on my face. Like Cinco
de
Mayo.
You celebrate it? You celebrate Cinco de Mayo.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
I'll tell this quick story. I took a trip to the Almas Awards a few years back. That, if you guys don't know that is the Latinos evening of celebration,
okay,
where they, you know, they give out awards to musicians and actors.
Okay.
And it's,
how come you've never been?
I don't know.
Well,
it's bullshit. Okay, go ahead.
Maybe I need to be like grandfathered in.
They're usually
like
hosted by like J-Lo or Salma
sure.
Hayek or someone. And it was very nice and flattering to be recognized for my craftsmanship
sure.
on the show. But when I showed up, like the first thing I had to do was like, sort of say, like, you know, on the press line, can I do all of my interviews in English? And as soon as I said that, I kind of felt a cloud, like, form
right
over my head. And for the rest of the night, I was a little bit sort of like, you know, I felt kind of like a marshmallow that had been dropped into a jar of peanut butter.
Yeah.
And nobody understood why I was there. And I kind of felt, you know, it was a source of shame. And you might,
because you couldn't speak Spanish.
And you
sure.
might think that would have been enough to sort of kick me into gear.
Sure.
And for about a week, I was all about, you know, like getting the Rosetta Stone.
And, right.
And getting back up on the horse.
But yeah. It's more about throwing you into it. Because like he was the same way when we made Club Dread. Like when we went down to Mexico and made Club Dread, it kicked in for you, right? Like don't you think it like
well,
it
there was,
reinvigorated your...
Well, it definitely had a thing because we... I was invited, or Fox sent me to Mexico City to promote Super Troopers.
Right.
This is while we were shooting Club Dread. Super Troopers was coming out in Mexico. And so they sent me there to do all the press junkets. And I was allowed to bring somebody, so I brought Stolhansky.
Right, right.
And
who kind of speaks a little bit of Spanish also.
He bullshat his
okay.
way through there.
Okay.
But so I did all my interviews in Spanish, and they provided me with an interpreter.
Right.
But I found, just like... I mean, it's a cliche when you go to a country where you don't speak the language. Once you're just in there speaking the language, you start to pick it up immensely because you have to.
Right.
And it just felt good. And also, like, they were appreciative. Like, they were...
Oh, they always are.
Yeah.
Which is why I probably should. It probably they would have been more impressed if I'd fumbled my way.
Because you're
through.
Making the effort.
Could you have?
Probably.
Yeah.
Embarrassingly. Okay. But I was like, there were people, there was a line.
Yeah,
and there were people behind me. And I
it's not
like,
the time for you to work on your Spanish.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
sure.
I just felt like in the interest of efficiency and I should just, you know, it was weird. It was a weird night, you guys. Needless to say, I've not been invited back.
Oh, really? Were you nominated for something?
I was, and I also I presented as well.
In Spanish?
That evening. No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Everybody was speaking English, oddly enough.
Okay. What was it? Were you nominated for best...
motherfucking actor.
Best white-looking Hispanic actor.
With a non-Hispanic made-up name? Yes.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks, man.
Okay. You got that on your medal, huh?
It was a big night.
Okay.
In some ways.
Nice. In some ways.
Yeah.
Have you met Genesis Rodriguez?
I have never met her,
what was that?
Like in the same room met her, but she was very close to being on our show several times.
Oof. She's fantastic. She was the lead actress in Casa de mi Padre.
Yeah.
With Will Ferrell.
Okay.
The Spanish-speaking film.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
Yeah, I really liked it.
I want to see it.
You'd love it.
I'm sure I would.
But she's in that, and I saw her on, I think it was Conan.
Mm-hmm.
She's fluent. She's from Miami, so she's fluent. English is her first language.
Right.
And she's hilarious.
Yeah. Okay. They call her G-Rod?
Well, I'm, you know.
Do anybody call you J-Rod? Do they call you J-Rod? Anybody call you J-Rod?
I got a lot of anyway. J-Ro.
No J-Rod, though?
No J-Rod. Hmm.
So if she married you, her name would be Genesis Rodriguez Roday.
I don't expect any.
Rod.
I don't expect anyone that ends up with me to take my made-up name.
Okay, so she'd be Genesis Rodriguez. Rodriguez.
They can keep their name, and if they really want to lock it down, they can be Rodriguez.
Good for them.
Okay, because like Charlie Sheen, he's really Ramon Estevez.
Right. Sure.
Carlos Estevez.
Carlos Estevez. Yeah. Okay, so his kid,
brother. His brother is.
His uncle is
Emilio Estevez.
Okay, so his son. So Emilio took his real name, Emilio
Correct.
Estevez, and Carlos Estevez went with Charlie Sheen, which was Martin Sheen's.
Right. He followed his father's. Yeah.
So they both took a version of their father's last name.
All right, can I tell the Roday story now?
Do whatever you want.
Let me tell the story about Roday. Okay, so a couple years, probably 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and I'm going to Florida with my family to visit the in-laws.
Okay.
Okay. And we get on the plane, and I'm with the brood. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I got the three kids.
All three.
I'm carrying the car seat. I got it all.
Yeah.
Right. And I walk on the plane, and sitting right there in first class is Roday. We stop. We shoot the shit, whatever. But it's like one of those things where you're on the plane, and there's tons of people behind you. You can't have a conversation. People are pushing you through.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm in steerage. You know, I'm in the back with the five seats in the back. You know what I mean? So we head back to the thing. I say, hey, Roday, blah, blah, we talk, we bullshit, blah, blah, we go. So I go in the back, I sit down, get my seat, get my family all situated. And this teenage girl sits down with her family in the row in front of us, probably like 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a flutter. Like she was out of control. Like she was red-faced and hyperactive and hyperventilating. And I came into the middle of the conversation as she was talking to her father, and she was like, "You don't understand. That's James Roday from Psych. That's James Roday." And I'm like, and I catch that. And I'm like, "Oh, sweet." And so like I eavesdropped into the conversation, and she was the biggest fan of yours, and she was so excited about who you were, but your father wasn't familiar with your show. So she's trying to explain who you were to her father, okay? And ultimately, it came down to this. She goes, "All right, Dad, imagine if you met Larry David. That's what it's like for me to meet James Roday."
Wow.
And so that was the combination. And so she went on for like, and she pulled you up on the computer.
Oh, goodness.
She pulled you up on the, she pulled the show Psych up on her thing.
Now, have you
and
done?
It was a wonderful moment for me to be listening into Roday getting his.
It's kind of like when you and I saw Jason Momoa on a plane. Conan the Barbarian was in theaters. We're like, "Ooh, Conan was on the and Khal Draga."
Did he have Lisa Bonet with him?
He was with Lisa Bonet.
That's a pretty cool one too.
Yeah, yeah.
You can get them both.
Yeah, they were next to each other.
Dreaded up.
Did you? Yeah, she was dreaded up, and he still had his long hair.
Yeah, but it was post Game of Thrones.
Post Game of Thrones, currently Conan the Barbarian.
Right. Right.
Were you in, like, did you ever do, like, Tiger Beat magazines or, like, pinups and things like that? Are there posters of you?
I bet there are.
I think Tiger. I think I missed the window for Tiger Beat because you know I was a grown man right. when
and
I.
There's
started
an internet
the show. Yeah.
No one gets magazines anymore.
Yeah. I mean, sure. There are. I've done photo shoots where I feel very silly the whole time, and those pictures are out there somewhere.
But I wish I could have bottled how excited this girl is. I mean, it happens every once in a while. We'll run into people who are friends of Super Troopers or whatever. But
for us,
it's funny to be a voyeur to a guy I know.
Well,
in that situation.
What we've managed to do, and you never know how these things come together. It always, you know, planets always have to align, and you never know when it's going to happen. But you know, this show has sort of found
a huge audience,
a very devoted sort of cult like, passionate group of fans,
which is fucking awesome.
And so there is no such thing as a bad. As a bad fan interaction,
sure.
For us, we never have drunken assholes coming up and like
we have yes, a lot of
it's
that.
Always it's always
the 15-year-old girl doesn't deliver the shot to you.
No,
but it's not that young. Your audience is older than that.
The 15-year-old girl doesn't call you a pussy for not
doing a shot.
It's weird, man. We've got fans that are, you know, in their teens and early teens and then all the way up.
But it's an older skewing thing, right?
You know, but I think when you last that long and you basically get old doing a show and you hold on to your fan base.
Yeah.
You know, the 14 and 15-year-olds who started with us at the beginning are, you know, graduating from college now, and they stuck with us the whole time. So, you know, it's been an interesting sort of thing to sort of experience fan-wise.
Let's talk about it more, though. Like, what... So 8 years, right?
8 seasons, yeah.
And how did you first? Was it a kind of a straight audition? You went in and auditioned for the show, or did you know people involved in the
Interestingly
show?
Interestingly enough, I was coming off of a film that I appeared in with you fellas.
Yes.
I think
there was it Dukes or was
well,
it Deer
no,
Fest?
No, I think they're working on the Criterion Collection now of Dukes.
Okay, yeah.
Correct?
Okay, yeah. So we'll talk about that next. But,
and we had just sort of the movie had just opened.
Yeah,
and it had a good opening.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, yeah.
So it was a good week to be in that movie.
Yeah,
and there was interest for this pilot.
Yeah,
and you know, usually the way it works is you go in and you read, and if they like you. You test and you sign a piece of paper,
right?
And
you're signed up for 5 years,
for
whatever.
6 years.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah.
And that's what it's based on, which is the most flawed. Like it's more flawed than you know the BCS.
Yeah,
the idea that as a show creator you're signing off on this person who you've seen in a room for 8 minutes,
right?
And I had the unique experience of saying, hey, I like this script, but I'd actually like to sit down with the man who wrote it. I'd like to talk to him about his vision for the show, the way that he works, the way that I like to work. And we sat down for like 3 hours.
And that's Steve Franks. Okay, got you.
Here. And it was great. And we talked about movies and his upbringing and my upbringing. And, you know, he basically came at Psych, you know, his take on the character was, you know, this is Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
And I said...
Meet Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah. I was like, well, what if it was, you know, what if it was Chris Knight from Real Genius? And it was ballparky enough that he was like, yeah, I could get behind that.
Yeah.
And once that sort of happened,
yeah,
I was like, well, you know what? You never know how these things are going to go. But I can get behind the experience of at least doing this pilot, which was like a 2-hour.
It was a movie-ish kind of pilot, right?
Real Genius is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Sure.
And that character is one of my favorite characters of all time. And in a way, it was sort of like, okay, I can do my tribute to Chris Knight.
Right.
And then, of course, it became what it became, and it evolved, and it's, you know, it became many things. But it actually started with two men sitting down and kind of mapping out
how they want to do it.
And you know, as you guys know, I do improv a lot. I don't always stick with what you put in front of me, and I wanted to make sure
he was okay with that.
He was totally okay.
And how much of the show is like that? How much of that show do you?
That first season is there's a lot of improv happening. You know, we were a new show. We're in a network that you know basically had one other show. We were all sort of trying to find our sea legs.
Yeah.
Didn't exactly. I mean, the conceit of the show is sounds fun when you put it on paper, but then it gets thin almost immediately.
Uh-huh.
And we had to figure out what that was.
Yeah.
But
it's the characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like what this fake psychic thing was going to be.
Sure.
So the first season was a lot of trial by fire, and you know, with any new show, you rarely have, you know, the creme de la creme of writers signing up to work on a basic cable show that they've never heard of,
right,
on a network that only has Monk.
Yeah.
So, you know, there were some growing pains, and we've kind of had to find our way. And
were the other actors, like Dula, am I saying his name right? Dula Hill?
Yeah.
Were they comfortable with the improv stuff? Were they, because some people aren't.
Well, that's what's interesting. He was coming off 7 years on an Aaron Sorkin show you cannot substitute a
contraction. You can't change
Seriously.
It. Yeah, sure.
So I think there was a little bit of culture shock for him, and there was an adjustment period. But I think that's what intrigued him about the project and why he sort of wanted to do it.
Sure, he must have been dying to babble a little bit.
Absolutely. And
did you know him prior or no?
No.
No, okay.
We absolutely did not. We met when he came in to test for the part.
Yeah.
But, you know, he had never done comedy really like that. And he'd certainly, you know, hadn't done a lot of improv-ing, you know, for the last 7 years. And I think initially he was like, what is this guy doing?
Yeah.
And and then once it became clear
this
that
guys that drive I, me crazy.
When it became clear that I wasn't going to stop doing that,
right? Stick to the fucking script.
He just
Jesus.
He got on board, and the evolution of Dula as a comedic actor was such a joy.
Yeah.
To watch.
Yeah, because I mean, West Wing is a you know a drama
and straight.
So he hadn't had comedy necessary experience, and he's kind of your straight man. He's kind of your right.
But you know, but as the show went on, like that character became so much more.
Yeah.
Than it was drawn to be.
Yeah.
As he sort of got more and more confident and more comfortable with doing what we were doing, and you know, by the end it was like we could riff for, you know, 8 minute takes,
yeah,
and just go and not have to talk about it beforehand.
Yeah,
you know, we just got to the point where, you know, I would throw something
that
out,
you're just comfortable with
he
each
could
other.
Pick it up, he knew what to do with it.
Yeah.
And so when he tested, did you already have the part, or were you still vying?
I did.
For it?
I was in. I got to read with every other actor for every other role in that show.
Okay,
it was a very sort of unique experience.
And was it an LA based casting situation, or was it? Oh, it was Julie Ashton, right? Julie Ashton, cast our pilot.
Julie came in later.
Oh, okay.
Love Julie, by the way.
Yeah, awesome. She cast our first pilot we ever did, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
For NBC,
love her.
Yeah.
She really got the show too. She came on. She kind of brought like a fresh, because you know she came in sort of at a midpoint almost.
Oh,
like,
okay.
Where you kind of need a little boost sometimes.
Yeah. Fresh thing.
Yeah, and she was great.
And did you? But I'm saying, like, did you get people from Canada, or was it predominantly?
No, it was
LA?
All America for the regulars.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was the pilot shot in Canada?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it sounds cool that like it seems like you've kind of like. Embraced it to the extent of like now, like you ended up writing shows and directing episodes, right? I mean,
you know, it was one of those deals where like, again, it was like all of the elements kind of just lined up.
Yeah. And you couldn't have imagined that you would have been that, you know,
here we were in Vancouver making a show where everybody else was down in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
The writers were down in LA. The producers were down, like the network execs, everybody was in LA and we're up in Vancouver on a network, like I said, that was kind of finding its way.
Yeah.
And it's like everything had to be exactly what it was so that ultimately for a period, you know, the inmates could start running the asylum.
Right. And was Steve Franks cool with that?
I think he recognized like probably more so than anybody else, because there were some people that were nervous.
Yeah,
that you know what, like I hitched my wagon to this guy, and he hitched his wagon to me, and we're gonna have to trust each other,
right?
And you know,
how long did that? Was it like halfway through the first season, or when did you realize that it was going to be like, I'm gonna get into this, man. I'm going to write some episodes.
He came to me in the first season and said, what do you think about doing like a Halloween episode, like a scary episode?
Uh-huh.
You know, and I had one terrible horror film produced as
a
writer.
Right. Skinwalkers. Yeah, okay.
Which was not a horrible script, but became a horrible movie.
that kind of stuff happens, man.
Yeah. But he knew that, and he was like, you know, I've never even attempted to write anything scary. What would you think about teaming up and doing? And like, are you kidding me? In the first season? So obviously I jumped at that opportunity, and we ended up kind of sending up Sorority House Massacre and getting John Landis to come in and direct it.
Oh, that's awesome.
And and that was my first writing experience on Psych.
Oh my God, that's great.
And from there, it just kind of blossomed. And then the only rule about me directing, because everybody knew that I wanted to direct, was you know, Steve had to direct first, which is obviously fair.
He did. He had not directed prior?
He had not.
Okay.
So he directed in season two.
Okay.
And as soon as he had, you know, put his feet in the pool, I was next. So I got to start season three.
Okay.
So, and it was, and again, it wasn't something that I ever had to negotiate or put into a deal or ask for. It was just like, hey, now that Steve's directed, you're next.
That's such a great opportunity to...
Insane.
Did you find it, because we've talked about this a lot also, because that's what we do. Did you find a problem acting and directing? I mean, you're the star of the show. Did you, was it tough for you? Was it...
What I found over the course, because, you know, I started directing more and more. I ended up doing multiple episodes per season.
And you ended up figuring it out.
You totally figure it out. Yeah. And by the end, because the first time you step behind the camera, you're leaning so heavily on your crew and people that, you know, TV is a machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That your head's just kind of spinning and you just want to make sure you don't screw it up.
Yeah.
Right. And you have the cocoon of the same crew, right? The same people you've been working with for years.
It's the best way to cut your teeth.
Yeah.
Because nobody's going to let you fall.
No, everyone's on
your
side.
In your head, you think you're going to fall.
Yeah.
But what you don't realize is that there's a 0% chance that you're going to fall.
It's weird. When I think about directing something for the first time, I can't – my fear is that I won't be able to fit – the two actors into the same frame. Like, I won't be able to do it.
Yeah, you'll be able to.
You will. You totally will. What you'll find is that, you know, you surround yourself with people who know more than you do, and you just, you know, you get better and better at articulating what you want, and there's a vocabulary that goes along with it. And
even if you don't know what you want, you pretend like you do know what you want,
because you can always change your mind.
Yeah.
And
but you always have an answer.
Yeah. I'll take the blue.
Because then they'll smell blood. Then you're fucked.
And then you pay attention and you listen, and the more you do it, the more you learn. And the next thing you know, you know stuff about the camera, and you know stuff about lenses, and then you're actually developing your own vocabulary. But what I discovered the more I did it was that acting became just a pain in the ass.
Yeah, yeah.
and I didn't enjoy it when I was directing.
I mean, I guess I find it like it's like, because it's an extra layer of something that, like, you have to remember your lines and that kind of shit. I mean, maybe the level of improv, if you're doing a high level of improv, maybe it's not a problem as much.
Psych helped because I've been, you know, when you play a character for that long, it does kind of become second nature at one point.
Yeah.
And you're not trying to invent something. You're not trying to create a character.
And it's similar. It's kind of similar to you. You. I mean,
there's so much of me bled into that.
Like, you're a wise ass, Rodé. Right?
Exactly. I'm just a wise. I'm a bushman, and
you're a smart wise ass,
and a wise ass,
but thick. But thick.
Thick, dude. Baseball style. And so in that sense, it was never like I felt like there was a conflict of interest or I was hurting the show.
Yeah.
But just in terms of, like, you know, the framework of a day. When you know that there's stuff that you want to do, and I would always try to, I would try stuff because I was like, you know what, these opportunities are gold.
Sure.
These are all Easter eggs.
Yeah, yeah.
Every time I direct, I can do something that I've never done before.
Right, and have that on your belt.
Yeah. So I always came in with a much fatter agenda than a normal director would.
Right.
Because I was like,
would that piss anyone off or no?
No. I mean, okay. I think it was
Dulé.
Be like, Jesus, bro.
Really, dude, we got to do this? I think the crew kind of got a kick out of it because every time I directed, we got to try something weird or different or bigger.
Right.
And Steve did the same thing. Then I would like, you know, I wouldn't be able to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the more you direct, the more I think, at least for me, the more precious I got about wanting to be able to sort of micromanage.
Yeah.
And, you know, before I move on, I want to know that
I got what I wanted.
What I had up here is now there.
Yep.
And you just don't have the time to do that when you're running back and forth and
also,
acting
in
every scene.
I mean, you're how quickly you see those episodes?
Certainly in TV,
7 days for what, how many pages?
Usually 55. Jesus. Our scripts were always too long.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Always too long.
Did you and Dulé ever bump heads as a director-actor team?
Never.
A creative fight with anyone, you think, or what, here and there?
Not really, man. We lived a charmed life up there. We're all incredibly supportive of one another. You know, Dulé has zero aspirations to direct.
Okay.
So he hasn't done one.
So it was very easy for him to just kind of jump behind me and say, I know this is something that Rodé wants, and I'm for it, and I'm all with it.
There's a thing that we talked about with some other guests and stuff, but our problem is, like, I think we do get into creative fights. We get into much creative fights, and yeah, depending on who's directing, whatever it is, and a lot of it is what is being too precious, I think. And I think the difference between movies and TV is maybe you don't have much less time to be precious.
You can pick like three shots,
right,
that you're going to take some time with,
right,
and then you have to know that you have, you know, five or six or seven scenes that you can do like that,
right,
to compensate.
And you have pages of dialogue you have to get through. And
so you basically come up with, okay, what's the fastest way that I can shoot this scene where two people are walking and, you know, nutshelling the case,
right,
so that later on, you know, when I have the crane, I might actually be able to come up with a shot that they can't cut.
Sure. Because it's too cool or too expensive.
Both. By the way, first lesson about using a crane in television. First, longest thing to set up, longest thing to shoot, first thing that goes.
Yeah. It's true.
Do you, like, when you're directing yourself, do you ever give yourself a money shot, like a slow motion or something like that?
I my episodes generally have the least amount of my character that we could get away with as a show. I often wrote most of the episodes that I directed as well, or co-wrote them, and it was like the Sean lightest episodes that I could get away with.
So you're not like, you know, hey, I worked out with my trainer today. My abs are looking fucking sick.
Let's do a shirtless shot.
It wasn't the was it Argo where Affleck was doing the shirtless pull-ups where he was glistening? He looked himself in the mirror. Yeah. It was the town.
Yeah.
Okay. Glistening, oiled, fully like blue moonlight.
Let's do another take.
Hold on. I'm just starting to get pumped.
Now, do you get involved in the edit, and how do you do that if you're on a production schedule as the lead actor?
You get 4 days to edit. That's like the DGA rule television.
Mm-hmm.
And I would generally get 36 hours because I would fly back on like a Saturday morning.
They did post in L.A. Oh, God.
And I would get like Saturday and half of Sunday. To do my edit usually.
So you're committing to it then. And then you have to go in, and how do you learn your lines for each week of shooting that day?
Yeah, I come in that day pretty much. Right. I kind of have a photographic memory-ish.
I could
like
tell.
The character.
I could tell.
Yeah,
like,
and that helps.
The character.
It's another thing about you that's so appealing.
It means I can look at it and have the gist of it, but never word perfect, which is why I think I would struggle on like a Sorkin show.
Sure.
Because my skill set would betray me. And I'd be like, but I'm so close. And they're like, but that's not how we do it.
I did a TV show once, and I made it a contraction of something. Like, you know, they are to there. And they're like, oh, you said this line wrong. And I was like, how did I say it wrong? Like, you said there instead of they are. And I'm like, really? Okay. Wow. That's what
the writer is king.
Like.
Writer's king at TV.
They like that. Yeah. That's what they want to do. I mean, you're lucky that you had such a great opportunity.
It's so bizarre. Like, as a writer, like, my first thing is like, dude, if you can make what I wrote better, please do it.
Go for it.
Yeah.
It's only going to make me look better.
Sure.
You know, there's no such thing as a bad idea ever. And if you can make it funnier, if you can make it make more sense, then do it. Because invariably, no matter what script you're working on, there's always going to be a couple things that you're just like, that sucks.
Yeah.
I never quite cracked that.
Yeah.
And if somebody can come in and crack it, do it.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, why not? Right?
But it is true. It's like, if I think about the different responsibilities I have in our films and stuff, you know, the acting and the writing, you know, it's the writer side is the douchier side of me. That's the side that wants to fight everybody on their creative suggestions.
Sure.
It's like, no, you don't get it.
Yeah. The director side is the power hungry side. So then that's where you're okay.
Yeah.
Then you just shut everything down.
I like that shit.
They shut the fuck up.
Yeah, fuck you.
So the new season just premiered, right?
January 8th. We just kicked off.
And that's season 8.
Season 8.
And is it the kind of thing like, I guess, are you guys done or you don't know?
Big mystery, man.
It's a big mystery. You don't know if this is it.
We don't quite know.
Did you put
if
a bow on it on the thing at the season or no?
You know what? We set out to make the best sort of 10 episodes for our fans that we possibly could.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like more so than any other season, we basically came together and said, okay, what are the coolest 10 things that we can give to them to say, we love you, thank you so much. That way, if it is the last season, you know, we went out right.
Right,
we did
sure.
It right. So... it was less about, you know, sometimes, you know, psych can get self-indulgent with like, you know, little things that an individual writer wants to do, because we have a ton of autonomy on that show. Yeah. But this time it really was about, okay, what have the fans been waiting for?
Spoil it. Right. Spoil it. Do it. Spoil it. Spoiler, everybody. Don't here it comes.
What do they really want? Where do they want to see these characters end up? Like, let's give them what they deserve.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's back it up a little bit, though, because, you know, obviously it does have a rabid cult following. When did that start? Like, when were you aware that this was happening?
Honestly, for us, it was the first time we went to Comic-Con, which I believe was after season 3.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, again, we're up in a bubble in Vancouver.
Right. You do 10 episodes a season?
16. We'd always done 16 until this last one, 8. And then, we knew we were on a TV show. And, you know, every once in a while in an airport or something, somebody will say, hey, dude, you're the side guy. Can you go like this?
Yeah.
But, but when we went to Comic-Con and they told us that they were doing our panel in, like, the biggest ballroom, we all panicked because we were like, this is going to be humiliating. It's going to be a third full.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to go out there. And, oh, gosh. And it was, like, oversold, and there were people lined up who couldn't get in. And we walked out, and people just went crazy. And I think that's the first time it hit us, like, oh, we're one of those shows.
Yeah.
Like, we're
cult following.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like, that's what we are. That's cool.
Yeah.
I'd much rather be that than a show that has 5 times as many casual viewers.
Right. Right. You have rabid fans.
Yeah. Like, it was really cool. And then each Comic-Con got progressively crazier and crazier and crazier.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, like, they start writing novels or something like that?
There's fanfics and novels and books and
of your character.
Bobbleheads and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Have you seen The Wolf of Wall Street?
I have not yet seen The Wolf
of Wall
Street.
Okay, do you know that Margot Robbie, the hot Australian?
Yes, the blonde girl.
Yeah. I was just reading an article that she's a huge Psych fan and loves your character and loves you.
There you go, Rode.
You just made that up.
I'm just fucking with it.
It was pure fallacy.
Why couldn't you believe that?
I could believe it, but I made it up.
Look at him. Fallacy. He's cut.
She's I like baseball players.
Yeah.
Did you, I don't know what your relationship status was all the way through the series. Any weird, like, psych groupie action that wanted you to, like, get mental on them or anything like that?
Man, talk about what a different experience it would have been for me if I had been a single man while I was doing Psych.
Uh-huh. Were you in a relationship the whole time?
Whole time. I mean, except for the first season.
Yeah.
But the first season I was completely consumed with, you know, being that guy and trying to figure out what the show is and not wanting it to suck. And look, my TV history pre-Psych was not great, you guys. It was I was starting to feel like, you know, you're only going to get so many opportunities, and I had never been the lead of a show before, and this one was like the shit. This one needs to be good. So that's where my head was at, and then from that point on, I was in the relationship. So
Does Psych play in Mexico?
It does.
What's it called down there?
Psych.
I think it's Psych.
Loco.
Yeah.
Loco.
Psych.
I think it's called Psych.
Es Psych. Yeah. Do you still have family in Mexico?
I do. I can't even tell you. I think border towns mostly.
Okay.
We didn't come from deep.
Not deep Mexico.
I mean,
shallow Mexico.
Well, he looks like a Mexico City Mexican.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's possible. I mean, I know.
Well, his mom's not Mexican.
This is true. My mother is white as the driven snow.
Sure. As is mine.
As is yours.
But you know, my father's from Argentina.
As is mine.
Yeah, yeah.
So Lemmy is an Argentinian name.
That's an Italian last name.
Okay.
But Argentina is...
Like Mount Ginobili also sounds Italian, but...
And he is.
He's an Argentine.
Yeah, because so many Italians and Germans moved to Buenos Aires.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that? Buenos Aires.
I like the way
Buenos
you
say Aires.
That.
Didn't you just win an award? People's Choice or something like that?
We did.
Yeah.
That was a surprise.
What in the heart of that? Like, were you there?
We were not. That award was not a part of the telecast.
Oh, was it? What was the award? I thought it was like funniest dude.
Yeah,
award.
We won best cable comedy.
Okay. Why would that not be part of
that? Seems like a big category.
You know, because they do movies too, and I think that's, you know, they want those big hitters.
But Psych is
to
big.
Show up. We're big in a snow globe filled with other culty type things.
I guess so, but I mean that's where it's at these days.
It was
that's
dude. It was awesome. Our fans, because you know that's like a voted on by the fans kind of thing, and they went crazy and to make that happen. And it's all them. All them.
What do you think the secret of success is? Is it the level of the comedy, or is it the quality of the mysteries, or what is it that
is it just you?
Is it Roday?
It's definitely not just me.
Is it Dulay?
As history pre-psych has shown, it was not just me. I think, you know, it's a tough one to answer because of the fact that, like, our audience is, we've cast such a wide net. And,
yeah.
And I don't know how.
Yeah.
But...
Well, no one really, like the USA Network thing, like nobody really knew where it was going to hit. Like you said, there's Monk, and then there's like
If you look at the rest of their, you know, they kind of found their groove after us.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's this one show that's like, which one of these is not like the other?
Yeah.
We were the oddball sort of.
But it had the similar sense of comedy, don't you think, as some of those other shows? Or no? or a comic drama kind of a.
Like a dramedy? Sure.
Yeah.
But we're the only show that was doing really weird stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We did weird shit.
Yeah. You
know? And
wasn't Monk a little bit weird?
I think Monk appealed to a slight an older crowd, older audience,
an older, more neurotic crowd.
We kind of became obsessed with the '80s on our show, and it was
all Tears for Fears stuff, and
it's totally steeped in '80s. And I mean, we just started paying tribute to our favorite movies and TV shows about, and you know, we became that sort of show that could do whatever we wanted.
Yeah.
And that was the only thing like that on USA.
Yeah.
And we were just sort of like this residue, leftover from a previous, you know, kind of regime.
Yeah.
But I think part of it is that we managed to crack some kind of formula where kids felt like it was okay to watch our show with their parents.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a rarity.
Uh-huh.
Like what I hear a lot of, which always surprises me, is, hey, we don't see our kids all week. And except for the hour that we come together to watch Psych. And I think that's something that has something to do with it.
Yeah.
The fact that we sort of bridged generations.
Now when we had Lance Henriksen on the show, we were talking about he's great. And he was talking about Millennium when they shot Millennium in Vancouver. And he said it was so grueling and went on for a while. And he was driving home when he got the call that it was canceled. And he hung up the phone, and he was happy. He was relieved and excited, and he did a little jig.
Yeah, he was like, I was like, fucking woohoo, which was fun to see. But yeah, I mean,
are you at that point? Like, is it that point for you, or if it didn't come back again, you'd be like, okay, I'm ready to move on to some other things? I mean, it's been a long time,
it's
right?
It's been a long time, and I have to say honestly, like, there's not a whole lot. That we left on the field.
Yeah.
I feel like we did just about everything we could think of. And I have such great affection for our fans who kept us on the air for all that time that I would never close the door. I would never just sort of say, I'm done.
Like, sure.
Psych
movie.
You know what
Psych
I mean?
Psych the movie. Hello.
But I also can't say like, oh no, if we don't make any more episodes, there's this and this that we never got to do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we really did, for better or for worse, hit or miss.
I mean, it's like over 100 episodes, right? How many episodes?
120 something.
God, that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Do you do they have big USA parties? Like the USA upfronts?
Upfronts got bigger and bigger. You know, it's funny. Like, now it's like they rent out a theater in, you know, in Lincoln Square and do upfronts for all their shows. And it's a big production. And when we started, it was like us and Tony Shalhoub and a couple of wrestlers in a bar.
Yeah.
And it was like, this is what we hope to be, you know?
Right.
It would be like a, you know, 20-minute speech from the head of the network, and then we would just start drinking.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
and
wrestling.
And that evolved, yeah. And that sort of evolved to like a whole, you know, a big production and pageantry. And yeah, they got big, USA.
And so would you be, like, the new shows, would you be hostile to the actors? Like when Feuerstein, like, walks into the room, are you like, I'm going to fuck you up, Feuerstein?
You know, we were granddaddies. We always, you know, we were the oldest show on the network, so we were always just kind of got to be cool. And people would ask us, what's it like? What is this? Or what should we expect? And all that stuff.
Like, did Feuerstein come up to you and be like, is USA cool to, like, work with?
Or? Totally. And, you know,
how can I get in with USA?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I became, like, the go-to guy for every other actor on every other show who wanted to direct. Because I got to – they let me do it first.
Yeah.
And they kind of opened a floodgate.
Sure.
Because once they said yes to me, how do you curate that?
Did Feuerstein direct?
Or? Oh, yeah. They're all directing at this point. But they would give all of them my number –
yeah.
and say, you know, call Rodé and ask him and have him give you some pointers.
Are there ever times where you're watching Royal Pains and you're like, that's my fucking that's my shot, Feuerstein?
Absolutely not.
Are you friends with Feuerstein?
Feuerstein's great. Like, okay. we see him...
I got some issues with Feuerstein.
Do you?
I've had some things.
I went to high school with Feuerstein.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Look, I see him once a year at the Upfronts.
No, Jay's friends with him. Jay's friends with him.
I know he likes to rap.
Yes, I know he likes to rap too.
And
Lazy Monday.
And he's got a lot of energy. He's always been awesome to me, and he's always bouncing around, and he's just got a lot of, you know.
No, he chutzpah. Have I told the story? He tried to psych me out one time at an audition, which I thought was fucking lame.
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. I went in for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Like, so I think the part that Frodo played.
Elijah.
Yeah. Elijah Wood, yeah. And so sorry about that. That's just the first thing came to my mind. And so
and then he nodded at me.
Yeah, and so I went into the room. I was sitting in the room, the waiting room. You know, you've auditioned many times.
Absolutely.
It's a shitty process.
Never great.
And, you know, whatever. So I'm going through my lines, and the other person in the room is Linda Cardellini. She's the only other person in the room. And so Feuerstein walks in, and he's like drinking like a Carl's Jr. soda, you know, with the straw. You know, it's like... Michael Madsen in Reservoir Dogs when he walks into the room and he's drinking the fucking thing. He's drinking the thing.
And but like you're not exactly he's slurping it.
He's slurping it. Yeah. He's slurping it. And like, you know, wanting you to know that he's slurping it.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So I'm sitting there, I'm going through my lines, and he immediately turns and starts hitting on Linda Cardellini. Like, hey, what's up? You know, he's like doing that kind of thing, and I'm like, oh my god, we're in a fucking audition thing here.
It seemed like a first meeting between the two.
It was.
Okay.
He didn't really know who she was.
Gotcha.
And but she's looking good. He's got some things for her, you know. He's got things to say to her. So he starts hitting on her or whatever, and she's like, "Oh, brother!" And you know, everyone's trying to prepare for this thing. So she gets called in, and so now it's me and Feuerstein sitting there in the waiting room.
Sure.
And I don't know the guy.
No.
Lemmy went to high school with him. I don't know. And so he turns to me. He's like, "Hey, what's your name, man?" I said, "It's Kevin." He goes, "Hey, Kev, how you doing?" I'm like, "Good, good." He's like, what part are you going in for? And I was like, oh, I'm going for the whatever. I named the part, whatever. And he goes, oh, yeah, me too. And I was like, yeah, good. And he goes, you're going to do it wrong. And I was like, what? And he's like, you're going to do it wrong. I'm going to do it right. And I was like, holy shit, is this happening? Is this happening right now? This dude's trying to psych me out. And then he continued to drink slurp his drink.
Staring at you?
Yeah. Yeah, and ultimately, like, you know, whatever, I went in and did the audition. But that was my That was my moment with him.
Goodness
which
gracious!
Which was, I thought, absurd.
Yeah, well, he came and reported it to me, and puts me in a difficult spot because I was friends with him in high school, and you know, but obviously now my loyalties are with Kevin.
Thanks, man. And you know, his loyalties are with Feuerstein because it's a USA thing.
I'm saying loyalties to no one.
That's what I'm saying.
That's a bit extreme.
It is.
If we fought Feuerstein and Rodé, I think they might take us.
Oh yeah, they definitely would.
Yeah,
they're both good wrestlers, right?
Yeah, Feuerstein and I were on the wrestling team together.
Have you good had wrestler. Fucked up any fucked up audition like that? Anybody ever psych you out like that?
Have you ever psyched anybody out?
Oh, look out!
Definitely never psyched anybody out.
So you weren't like
you
a
wouldn't
prickish.
Do that. Rodé's a good guy.
I'm trying to think, like what was my night? You know what? I had an audition at a theater, and it was for a play. It was a play audition.
Okay.
I was in New York. I had just gotten out of college, and I just gotten out of NYU, where you teach you to take yourself very, very seriously, dramatic actors.
Okay, you were a theater guy, right?
I was a theater guy.
Okay.
And I went in to read for this. It was an off-Broadway play.
Okay, off Broadway or just off Broadway?
I think it was an off because I think that was like a big deal for me at that point.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
It was just the single off.
Okay.
And
I did an off-Broadway play, and I thought I was hot shit.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff.
But it was
stuff.
Above a deli, still, someone's apartment.
Still counted so as an off-Broadway.
A lot of good stuff happens off-Broadway because you know they don't have to sell millions and millions of dollars in tickets.
Right.
So they can do interesting stuff. But I got a little out of control in the audition, and I thought I was feeling it. Like, I thought I was, like, I thought I was reaching places that were going to be very impressive.
Right.
And I did the thing where it was, like, the director and two producers sitting behind a table and then my space.
Yeah.
And I crossed the line from my space into their space.
Oh, fuck.
And I slammed my hand down on their table.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I was playing the whole thing to the director because I was like, I'm going to engage her.
Sure.
And she's going
to sell it.
And she's going
to
believe this.
Yeah.
And I'm going to walk out of the room with this role.
Yeah.
And I got all worked up, and I'm doing my thing, and I got right up in her, and I, when I slammed my my hands down, like the moment that that happened, like she went back in her chair, and she was like, whoa, 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 that's it. And she cut me off.
Really?
Like right then and there. She's like, you never, ever, ever do that.
You know what?
Never cross the plane?
You know what? She's wrong. She's wrong because you hear some of these stories, legendary stories, like about how Sylvester Stallone got his first part in Woody Allen's movie, which I think was, I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah.
It might have been Annie Hall.
What did he do?
Doesn't fucking matter. What he did was he went in there, Woody Allen didn't give him the part, and then he and the another one of the actors waited for Woody Allen to come out, and they put like grease in their hair.
Yeah.
And they mugged him outside of the the casting space.
I've never heard that story. Really?
And then they were like, because he told them they weren't scary enough.
Ooh.
So then they mugged him, and then they were like, now, do you think we're fucking scary enough?
Right.
And he was like, okay, you got the fucking part. I'm getting the part.
That's
but
awesome.
I think it's like, isn't that what it's always like the person who makes the difference.
But you didn't get the part. I mean, it was obviously.
My audition was finished right then and there. She invited me to leave. And then that, her piece of advice to me was don't ever, ever, ever do that.
Who is she now?
I don't even remember
where
who
is she
was. She was an older
lady.
Woman.
An older woman.
But yeah, talk about like juxtaposition of me thinking I was on fire.
Yeah.
And then hitting the bricks.
Yeah.
Your Dukes of Hazzard audition was fucking great though.
The funny thing about Dukes of Hazzard is according to Jay, I was the first person to read for that part.
Yeah, well, because I mean, they had made offers to people, and
in the audition process, I was like,
they didn't read anyone for it. Like they made, I think like Matthew McConaughey guys, you know, they were going for him or something like that. I can't remember what it was.
I'd gone in on like the first day of auditions because you know it's mandatory. You know, SAG makes you read a certain number of people for every role.
Absolutely,
And I went in and like the very first.
Well, because we didn't know you. You know, Jay didn't know you. We didn't know you. You just came in bald.
Came in, read it, and then you know, lots of time passed.
Yeah.
That's
when the offers were being made.
All the offers being made.
Yeah.
And then I'm stuck on the 405, and I get the call that like, hey, a whole bunch of people almost worked out but didn't work out.
Yep.
You got to be on a plane tomorrow.
Yeah.
It was one of those deals.
Yes.
And then when I and this is great because it takes you right into the second best story that I have from my experience, my initial experience on Dukes, which is, I show up and Jay's like, dude, I can't believe, like, the only thing I was hesitant about once we knew that McConaughey and all these people weren't going to do it was, I was like, you know, the casting director was Mary Vernou, and she's like, well, Rodez, he was always your favorite. And he's like, but he's the first guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I can't cast the first guy that came
into
the room.
You don't marry the first girl you fuck.
Exactly. So I guess he got over that, and that was awesome because I got to come up and meet you guys, and that was great. But this is what happened.
Okay.
I show up, and the first piece that I'm supposed to shoot was the little piece where...
is it on the road?
Then we're blocking
them. Yeah, right.
And
right.
we come out.
It's
and
like kind
our,
of the ending, like more closer.
Yeah, it's me and my may he rest in peace.
Mike,
Roof.
The rooster. What was his name? Mike
Chicken. Michael
the
Roof.
Chicken. Roof. Okay.
Yeah. We you know confront Bo.
Right.
And we didn't get to it.
Because the sun went down.
The sun went down.
Right. Right.
And I wasn't on the schedule again for a while.
Okay.
And they didn't know when they were going to get back to that scene.
Right.
Right.
So immediately I thought, shit, I wasn't on camera.
Like, yeah. Right. They're gonna
I was
come.
Not committed to camera. They now have an opportunity to offer this part to seven more guys.
Right. Okay.
And I went back to L.A. and I was just like waiting for that phone call. Like, hey, they're gonna pay you off because, you know, Gil Bellows is in. Or whatever. Whoever that would have been at the time.
Right.
Gil Bellows is awesome, by the way. But yeah, and then I was just sweating it out, man.
Yeah.
And then I got the call of like, okay, ready to get
come
you
on back.
Back
down.
And that's when I was like,
and you're psyched.
How long was that period of time?
Dude, I think it was like a week and a half.
Okay.
Yeah, because that was a super long shoot.
And then when I went up the second time, like, they didn't want me to leave. Like, I was just up there.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah. Let's get more stuff from him.
And that was the experience.
Red day.
And it was great.
No, that was great. I mean, it was awesome that you came in and you got to have fun doing that. I mean, that was a fun part.
Oh, it was a great part.
And it's the bad guy, kind of a bad guy.
Totally. And you guys were great. And again, you kind of, I came in with an idea and Jay was like,
cool. Cool, do it.
I was like, really?
Go for it.
Yeah.
That was also an odd movie because it was a huge studio film.
Yeah.
Where it never felt like anybody was like whispering behind the camera.
Yeah.
Kind of just felt like we were all doing whatever the hell
moments,
we wanted.
There were those moments. And like, you know, I mean, Jay had a few major fights and, but for the most part, I think it was a benefit. Like it was, you know, guys like Bill Gerber and stuff like that who were producing the movie and that Warner Brothers had a lot of confidence in, and they took a lot of that heat off. And then also they got, you know, I think for those major roles, they got all the people that they wanted. And so they were very happy having like Knoxville and Burt Reynolds and Willie Nelson and made it a valuable thing to them. And then it was just like a don't fuck it up kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, we had had all the
Jessica
fights
Simpson.
In the writing. And Jessica Simpson. We had all the fights in the writing rooms and all that shit. And
but, you know, that was pretty low pressure because they were like – that was an open-ended deal there too. I mean, they had us down there in Baton Rouge just writing pages and like just seeing what was good and shooting them.
Wow. Yeah, and then the same thing. Then they kicked me out at one point because, I played that character, the character Sheev, you know, the ball character, and it was similar. It was like we shot something very early, and then I didn't shoot for a long time, and then I hung around there, and then I shot something, and then I finished my last scene, and like 3 days later was the wrap party.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh sweet, I'll just hang around for the wrap party, and they're like, no, we're gonna send you back, and I was like, well, I've been here for like 3 months. I mean, can I just stay for the wrap party? Like, no, we're gonna. You're gonna cut off your hotel room, so and I was like, oh,
yeah.
And then they kicked me out
because that $600 is gonna make a dent.
Yeah. Wow.
And here's the thing: the funny thing about it was, my brother was a grip on the movie, and my parents had gone down to visit him and me.
Yeah.
At that point, and they kicked me out, but my parents stayed and they went to the rap party.
And your brother?
Yeah.
You were not at the rap party.
I wasn't, and I was on the invite of the rap party. Like I was, like it was a picture of me in my underwear with a shaved head.
That's crazy.
And they. They booted me out
of
there.
That's cray cray.
It is.
How's Pat, by the way?
He's doing great. He's big time. He just key gripped Cameron Crowe's new movie.
Oh, that's awesome.
In Hawaii.
He's a good man.
And he got married.
And he got married.
But please.
He did 3 months in Hawaii.
Please give him my congratulations.
I will. I'll see him in a couple of days. Yeah. But Duke's Hazzard was a good experience for you, though. I mean, it's a good.
Ah, oh, dude, I had a blast.
What I mean, up to that point, you'd been, you know, the working actor, getting on TV shows and da 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 da. I'd done some
indie stuff, but that was easily the biggest thing that I had ever done.
Yeah, and it was fun because there were other people like that, like Mike Weston, and
who became one of my very best friends.
Okay.
By the way,
we met on that movie. Yeah,
yeah,
great guy.
Just played the lead in my first movie.
Did he?
So like that became that.
That's awesome.
Wow.
All
these
See,
guys.
That's works because for us it's the same way. Like because we did Dukes and people can love it or hate it, we did it, and that's how we were able to make Beer Fest. That's how they allowed us to make Beer Fest, which was the next movie we
did. Speaking
of
Beer Fest, you guys.
Yes.
This is crazy. This is what I can't wrap my head around. Like the psych stuff. You can look at little pieces, and it's like, okay, I guess I can sort of understand, you know, how we kind of became what we were. But this is crazy because when Jay called and said, "Hey, come do this,"
right? You're the messenger.
I'm the messenger
that delivers the beer to the Germans,
and I get hose shoved up my ass and up my nose, and they kill me.
and you have a nice hair doing that.
And I did. And
the page boy wig.
And he's like, "Come do this, and you can do anything you want."
Right.
I was like, really? He's like, yeah, you can look however, whatever you want to do.
Whatever you want to do.
So I came in, and I was like, okay, I want a page boy wig and a hat and the lederhosen, and I'm going to give myself like a chin strap on top of that.
Right.
Basically saying, okay, yes, I will come up and play with you guys because I missed you guys, and I will have tubes shoved up my ass, but I'm going to make myself look essentially unrecognizable.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I thought I did a decent job
of doing that. I think so, too.
At least three times a year.
Yeah.
Usually in a crowded airport. Or a casino. From across the room, regardless of what I look like, or if I have a full beard or a hat on or whatever it is, some drunk guy will scream out, "Fucking Beer Fest!" and point at me.
Right. But don't you think that's a connection through psych, though? Like, they're like, oh, that's the guy from psych, and the guy from psych had that part in Beer Fest.
Maybe they connected those dots.
Yeah, by the way, that is our experience that we were talking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's us in airports.
Usually then they come up with like a boot, a glass boot or something to chug.
But I'll say this. I mean, after psych, I get more Beer Fest than anything.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Which is weird. I'm in the movie for
2 minutes. But you were excellent.
You were wonderful in it.
How long were you there? Like for one day or how long were you there?
I was there for one day and it just happened to line up with the rap party. So that was fun.
Oh, good. So that's good.
I can't. The reverse of your story.
I know.
Because this is no shit, not just because you're sitting in front of me, but I have, and I enjoy your character in Beer Fest so much because I always forget that you're walking into that scene.
Yeah, you always forget it's Rodé.
Yeah, and then it's like, oh, fuck, it's Rodé in that wig.
Doing the fucking, the foppish German accent.
Yeah. I'm going to go home and watch that.
Special delivery.
It did not end well for me.
I was reading that your writing partner is a guy named James DeMonaco.
James DeMonaco is sort of our mentor.
Okay.
My best friend, Todd, who you guys have met, and I were sort of the partners, and he sort of took us under his wing while we were all working on a TV show that he created, and as a result, we ended up writing Skinwalkers as a trio.
Yeah.
Was he Coop's friend?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a Gary Nadeau, James DeMonaco.
Oh, I remember they wrote like a couple movies. The Narrator, maybe?
The Negotiator.
The Negotiator. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah,
that's a very different movie.
Yeah. JD had a writing partner named Kevin Fox that they had kind of grown up together, and they had a whole run as a partners who wrote action movies.
Yeah. Okay.
And then they sort of amicably went their separate ways, and he wants to be a filmmaker, and somewhere in the middle there, we hooked up with him, and he was great to us and kind of taught us a lot about writing and wrote that script with us.
And that was all pre-psych, right?
It
was
pre-psych. All,
and so then that you just wrote, it's like a werewolf
we
thing,
pitched
right?
him. Or? We pitched him this idea,
and
thinking that, you know, maybe he'll give us some great notes.
Yeah.
And he dug it so much that he was like, let's write it together. And we're like, are you kidding?
Yeah.
And that really helped considerably in us, you know, ultimately being able to sell that script.
Yeah.
And it can be made.
Did you hook up with him through an NYU connection? Or
hooked up with him because he created a short-lived Fox series called Ryan Caulfield Year One and cast me in it. And that was the job that moved me from New York to L.A.
Oh, okay.
And we only shot, I think, 7 or 8 episodes, and it aired like twice.
Did you have a good-sized part in that?
I mean, I had a good-sized part.
Were you Ryan Caulfield?
I was Ryan Caulfield's bad boy best friend. That was
gonna you were.
What's the character's name? Come on.
Vic.
Yeah, that sounds tough.
Yeah. Vic the Dick.
Ryan was, this is one of those ideas that sounds great in a, like in a room across from executives, and then once it comes time to execute it, people are like, oh. But it was basically like Dawson's Creek meets T.J. Hooker. Like he decides to skip college and go straight to the police academy.
Okay.
And then he graduates, and he's basically a 19-year-old beat cop.
Okay. But like in a comic way or
no,
a drama?
This is a drama way. Okay. And we were in Philly? Yeah, we were supposed to be in Philly.
Right.
In a rough area.
Sure.
So he had all of his high school friends and all of the hookups and the girlfriend and me who was going to go in. I think I was going to end up being a drug dealer and all that stuff. But then he had the second world, which was, you know, T.J. Hooker with his older partner and, you know, responsibilities and, you know, moral corruptibility and all
sure,
that stuff. And
the cop part.
Yeah, and that was the that was the mashup. Needless to say, it was a quickie.
Okay.
But
it established a good relationship.
Established that relationship with James, who, by the way, earlier last year made the movie The Purge, which was hugely successful, and he's now making the sequel. So.
Oh, wow.
Good for him.
Yeah, great for him.
I just watched The Purge. He wrote Jack.
He also wrote Jack.
Robin Williams.
Yeah. Gary. I remember that.
With Gary.
You said that you directed your own movie. When did you? Just recently? Or
yeah.
What was that
in March of this past year, right?
In a hiatus?
Right before we went back to shoot the final season.
Okay.
This is a script I'm sure you guys have heard me talk about at least once, but it's I've been peddling it for about 8 years.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd been going back and forth with Jay and, you know, how do I get money? How do I raise money? How do you guys do it? And I thought I'd turned over every rock, and it was just a uphill all the way sort of, you know, exercise. And finally, after all that time, I landed with the right people who, for the first time in 8 years, someone actually sat me down and said, you don't need all this to make this movie. You can do it for this.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it was like a third of what I had always thought that I needed. And nobody else could tell me how to get this budget down.
Yeah.
And these guys did, and I ended up shooting in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
After investigating every tax credit the world has to offer, I ended up shooting in our own backyard.
Right.
And
which means you have access to great crew and people you know and good actors that you know.
So
the beauty
much
of
better.
Shooting here.
It was unbelievable. Yeah. And we shot in 18 days, and we spent less than $1 million. And
were the financiers people who had made films before, or was it?
They're a sort of like an all-in sort of service production company called Siren. They have stages everywhere now. Yeah. The Biggie's on Sunset and Gower. They have a gigantic, they call it the Cube.
Yeah.
And they also have all the equipment that you need. And they also have Siren Digital, which is their own post facility. Yeah. So it's like a one-stop shop.
And did your kind of notoriety fame get you in the door with them?
It, helped it certainly helped a little. What they were looking to do was kind of make the transition from tons of commercials, you know, tons of promotional stuff, music videos, to features. And Gravy was the...
That's your movie.
Yeah. It was kind of like the guinea pig sort of experiment of, you know, can we get into the movie business as well?
And it was, and it worked for them. I mean, in terms of,
I think so. I mean, they've done more since. Yeah. So okay. I think it certainly worked.
What's the movie about? Can you say?
Sure. I mean, it's a Halloween movie.
Okay. Is it a horror movie?
It is a dark comedy with with
double dark
elements of
it sounds like a Thanksgiving genre. Movie
gravy
yeah
okay it's a Halloween movie about a Mexican restaurant.
I'm
listening.
closing up, everybody's trying to get out of there, so it's really just the employees and one sort of stray patron left. And then a couple people come in who have different ideas of where the evening's going to go.
Yeah.
And it ends up being a night of gaming and libation.
Okay.
And a whole lot of blood.
Okay.
And a fight for the survival, and it kind of becomes about who's going to see the dawn.
Okay. Ensemble-y? Yeah.
Total ensemble.
Are you in it?
For about 2 minutes.
Okay. So you were going behind the camera.
Do you play a Mexican character?
I play white trashy sort of Dulé and I appear together.
Okay.
As a fun thing.
Yeah, know? Yeah, sure.
And but I can't. I mean, I'm so. It was the most gratifying creative experience of my life.
Yeah,
because it's a crazy movie.
Yeah,
and that was part of the reason why it was so damn hard to get made.
Yeah. And it was grueling.
It was grueling. We had no time. We didn't have enough money. We had a
how
lot
different
of,
is
special
it
effects.
From your TV directing? Like, what was different about that? Like, just the support staff.
You don't
the...
have to fit anything inside of a box.
Yeah.
So it's like you're unleashed.
Yeah.
I wasn't working with nearly as experienced of a crew because when you have no money to pay anybody, you know, you have hungry young people.
Do you have some students?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. We had sort of a moving kind of cycle of B camera operators.
Yeah.
It just got to the point where I was like, I don't even need to commit this man's name to memory because he's not going to be back tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah. I think in 18 days we had like 6 B cam operators. Because as soon as you know a better job comes along,
sure, they're gone. Yeah.
So it was a little bit of that, and it was a really ambitious shoot with a lot of effects, but luckily, you know, 98% of the film takes place in one location, which we built.
Yeah. The restaurant.
The restaurant on a soundstage.
Okay.
Which definitely helped us, and we kind of we shot.
Yeah.
Chronologically, which is also something you rarely get to do.
Yeah.
But helps enormously on a movie like that in terms of continuity and blood and gut continuity, because you're shooting in the proper order.
Yeah.
So we did as much as we could to help ourselves, but then we just kind of had to throw caution to the wind and go for it. And look, there's some stuff that will probably keep me up and cost me a few years at the end of my life forever.
Sure.
But for the most part,
for things you think you did incorrectly or things that you had to cut.
Things that I wish I would have known. Like, at end of the day, I just wish I'd had more time and a little more money.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like that would have solved everything.
Yeah.
But there was like, the first 5 minutes of the movie, I cut on the first day of editing.
Okay.
It was like a preamble that led up to,
like, totally cut it out.
Dude, it was a full day of shooting.
Sure. There's a wasted day of shooting
that
I
whacked. And it's just like, oh my God, if only I had known that I wasn't going to use that, or that I didn't need to use that, because the movie really starts here.
Yeah.
I would have had another full day to put towards stuff that got short shrifted.
Sure.
You know, another couple takes of an effect shot or stuff like that. So it's that stuff that kind of makes you crazy.
But I don't think that ever changes, though.
It never changes, you know, because even Scorsese will say, oh, I didn't have enough time.
If I had another day.
Really?
If I had another dollar.
But, you know, end of the day, I think we did a lot with a little, and the cast was unbelievable. Just a ridiculous.
So Weston was in it.
Weston, Jimmy Simpson, Gabourey Sidibe, Sutton Foster, Molly.
Ted Griffin's Sutton Foster's Ted Griffin's
fiance. Okay. Molly Ephraim, Sarah Silverman. I don't want to forget anybody because it's a small ensemble. Yeah. Paul Rodriguez, Gabriel Luna. It was.
Oh wow!
It was so much heart and belief and faith collectively that they were putting into my sick, twisted, depraved
into
vision.
Into Rodé?
That it was truly humbling. Like, every day was kind of an emotional experience because you're just like, wow, these people are just giving it everything.
They're committing.
Yeah.
And so you finished it and it's edited and it's done or no?
Everything is done, man.
And what do? You got to go find someone? You got to go find a distributor? You got to put it into festivals? What do you got to do?
The fun part, seeing if anybody gives a shit.
Did you submit it anywhere? Have you?
South By. We finished in time to submit to South By.
And?
We'll find out very soon.
Love South By.
It's a great festival.
It's a good place for this movie, too.
Yeah. Rowdy. I mean, it's rowdy, and it's a,
And I'm a Texan.
Right.
And those Alamo Drafthouse guys, this is right up their alley.
Yeah, they're fantastic, those guys.
I actually kind of feel like if we don't get into South By, then I may not have a festival film on my hands.
Really?
Maybe.
I mean, there might be other crazier Telluride.
If I want to start going like the genre route, then like maybe.
Yeah.
Even the Hamptons Film Festival.
Yeah, but South by Southwest is, I mean,
it
that's
feels
great.
It feels kind of perfect. I mean, it's
and you made the deadline. You got in under the deadline, and so okay.
And now we'll wait and see. I mean, you think about a movie like From Dusk Till Dawn, and there's enough of that going on here that,
in that movie.
It seems like it should appeal to those guys.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good, man.
Thanks.
What's Red Dog Squadron?
That is the non-for-profit theater company that a buddy of mine from NYU named Brad Rader and I started here in L.A.
Still exists?
Still exists. The exciting news on that front is that our company and another company, do you guys know Matt Shackman?
Mm-mm.
You guys ever run into Matt?
No. The actor?
Super awesome guy. Directs a ton of TV. He does half of the It's Always Sunny's every year.
Oh, okay.
And he did a bunch of Sykes as well. He has a theater company called Black Dahlia, and a property came on the market for the first time in like 30 years called the El Centro Theater, which is on El Centro in Hollywood. It's actually the oldest
El Centro? Where is it?
It's just east of Vine, and it's just north of Melrose.
Okay.
And
that's a good spot.
It's the oldest theater in Hollywood. Charlie Chaplin was the first artistic director.
Really?
And he and I sort of teamed up and said, you know what, this is kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing. We're space pirates, meaning every time we do a show, we have to hunt around to try and find the best deal.
Yeah.
He had been producing out of a tiny little storefront theater down on Pico that could only seat like 30 people.
Yeah.
So together we bought a theater.
Wow!
Like instead of a zoo, we bought a theater.
That's fucking great.
And
you bought a zoo.
And it was the worst business decision that two men could make, hands down. But we knew
Is it a money pit or what?
It's a money pit.
Will you only ever lose money?
Yeah. And producing theater in Los Angeles is completely thankless.
Yeah.
But our hearts got the better of us, and we are in the midst of a full-blown renovation so that we can kind of reintroduce the space to the community, hopefully by the summer.
And will it be called Red Dog Squadron, or will you call something different?
It'll be called the Circle Theater because we wanted to kind of privilege the history of it,
sure.
And that's what Chaplin called it. And it's two spaces. So,
like a bigger and a smaller?
And a slightly smaller. Yeah. So that, you know, you can have two productions going simultaneously. And I think for the grand opening, each of our companies will probably produce something to sort of kick it off.
Okay.
Do you have any ideas of what you want to do?
We know our play, yes. I commissioned a buddy of mine and a very talented playwright named Gabe McKinley to specifically write the first show that we're going to do. And it's good.
So you always do original.
Yeah, that's part of our
deal.
Like,
could we come in there and do a show, or does that be like highbrow? You got to be all highbrow stuff.
Absolutely, you guys.
Like, we come in and do a little stage show in there?
Are you crazy?
We have an idea.
Are you insane?
Oh, we do have an
idea.
We have an idea for a stage show.
If you guys do a stage show and don't do it at my theater, we're done.
This is great. This is great.
I warn you, like, our idea for a stage show is not an original. It's a cover. We'd be doing somebody else's work. But we would, you know, maybe...
We'd put a new spin on it.
But you'd be putting your spin on it. And plus, you know, you guys are my boys.
We shouldn't give it away, though, right?
Well, I want to know what his...
Off mic. I'm going to ask him that.
You want to save it for not on the air?
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know.
We can talk about it.
It's such a good idea, though. I don't want to
give it away. Is all of this, like, is this, I didn't ask you guys, all of this is, like, live?
No, we go up every Wednesday, so we're recording.
So we have the option to take out stuff.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes. Which means you can take something out if you want.
Yeah. But but we can talk about it.
You just tell us.
Nobody's going to steal this idea.
I don't know. It's such a good idea.
It is, but I'm going to tell it anyway.
Okay.
We're, Kevin and I are going to do a production of Mice and Men.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh. You know, you can piggyback the Broadway production that's going up later this year.
Okay.
It'll
we
be,
have a different spin on it, though.
But the fact is, people will be talking about it again. People will remember what it is because it's going to be on Broadway with James Franco and Chris O'Dowd.
Oh, really?
Okay. Well, the twist we were going to put on it was that I would be Lenny.
And you would be
George. And I would be George. Huh?
Hey.
Come on.
Now,
you ever think about that?
You guys just want to do like it's just a straight, honest, earnest.
Well, see,
production?
That's the thing. Like we've talked about it. I mean,
we started adapting it. Like I have about 10 pages done.
Yeah.
And
but like
it moves to more fun. It's a little more funny.
But then the question is does that joke wear out after 1 minute?
That's really the question.
And should we just shouldn't we just make it that you're Lenny because it's you're so obviously Lenny?
No, because it's the hook. Yeah, the hook is you're the big dumb guy and I am the little smart guy.
No, I know. Except that it would be so much better to just put us into the types. I mean, now listen, we're
but
not.
But then you're just doing what they're doing. Yeah. You're doing what James
Franco's
doing.
No, but then we're
going
to put our special twist on it,
which is what naked.
Something else. The thing I don't want to talk about on air.
Okay.
No, I don't even
know
what it is.
What that is.
It says this is not us disagreeing. This is me playing devil's advocate because I'm a big advocate of playing Lenny myself.
Right.
And Kevin playing George. But then the question is, would the joke run out? Would it be better if we just did it?
I don't know. If you did sort of like your own little, you know, lizardy mashup of Mice and Men and got it to like a, you know, shoot it out of a cannon and, you know, no intermission, you know, make it like a 50-minute sort of thing.
Right,
yeah.
You know, like an abridged fun version.
Sure.
And you flip the stereotypes, then definitely.
Boom.
It could be like...
We could make money for their theater.
Yeah.
We could get people into the Circle Theater.
Sure, we could do our part. When, like, it's time for me to kill a mouse or something, like, it's a struggle for me. And when you're trying to be smart, smart.
And then Curly's wife can actually... She can beat the shit. Like, it's a duel.
Right.
It's a good fight.
And it's an accident. It's a true accidental death. Where she's got you dead to rights.
She's kicked my ass.
She has you in a headlock.
Yeah.
And she slips.
She slips.
It's like a $1 million baby.
Yeah.
Dude, that's great.
We're giving too much away.
All right. That's
giving
enough.
Too much away.
Don't worry.
You can trim it back.
No, this is called advertising. This is long
promotion.
Lead.
This is like a trailer.
Yeah.
It's a trailer.
It's a teaser.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I have a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jesus, as I am both, I've worked with you,
right.
but I'm also a fan of you guys and what you do, and on behalf of lizard fans everywhere, mm-hmm. and a lot of dudes who stop me and ask me, I have to ask you guys, what's happening with Super Troopers sequel? Because that's the question that I get more than anything.
Yeah, but us too.
Yeah, we do.
No, it's in full blown action right now. We've sealed the deal with Fox.
That's amazing,
and
people are going to be very excited about this.
And so the script is written, and
all five of you,
all five of us, yeah. And then we are now the deal. Without getting too much into it, the deal is such that we're going to bring the money to the table.
Okay.
And so we are out there right now putting the financial package together. Yeah.
We're fundraising again.
And
have you guys thought about doing any...
a Kickstarter?
Yeah.
Yes.
We've talked about...
Crowdfunding?
Crowdfunding,
You know how many Super Troopers fans are out there. It's crazy.
I know.
It's part of the long plan. We're really in the early stages of it. I mean, we signed the deal last year, but then ran into the holidays.
Sure.
Yeah, last fall. Yeah.
So
what is Fox is taking? They just distribute it?
Distribute it.
Okay.
It's a straight up distribution deal. Okay. And then so we're going to go put the financial package together. And so we just went out with the, you know, the paperwork and the sending the script to the investors and that kind of stuff. So
I think the fans
would
love to help you guys make that movie.
No, I think it's due. I think what we're trying to figure out is what the appetite is in on the equity side, and then we'll figure out what the appetite is on the crowdfunding stuff, and then see what kind of budget we can put together and do it.
But interestingly, you know, and not in a bad way, it's just sort of like I had maybe forgotten a little bit, or I had been naive. It's interesting because you start down this road again, and you realize no matter what the track record is on the first thing, you're still going to run into all of the same hurdles that you encounter on any independent film.
And we also have like the best piece of the puzzle already in place. We have committed distribution from a major studio, but still, it's still a matter of going to get the money.
It's always the bottom line.
It's still the money.
Yeah.
You know?
So, but yeah, it's happening.
Now, are there versions of the film that you can make based on how much money you scrape together, or do you have to have X amount of dollars to make this movie right?
No, I think we're prepared to make the movie.
For whatever you end up
with. Yeah, and I think, you know, it could be a scale of things, and you know, we're hoping, I mean, on the first one, we didn't get paid, right? Because we made the first one for $1 million. And so the hope is that, you know, we can pay our rent a little bit doing this one. And so that's what we're shooting for.
Yeah, but there's a studio requirement for a minimum. So, okay. So we can't actually just do it on the cheap. We have to raise a certain
amount. We have to have X amount of dollars in order to trigger X amount of screens.
Yes. Okay. And it's not a low number.
Yeah.
Shit.
So we have to raise a lot of money.
Okay.
Which we are currently doing. Just had a big, huge Broken Lizard conference call about it yesterday.
Okay. Yeah. People have been contacted.
All right.
So
there's a plan in place, and it's in motion.
Well,
but people get mad at us. They're like, "What the fuck? Make the movie!" We're like, "We're trying to make the movie."
People don't understand how difficult,
how hard it is.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Another question we get asked a lot is about the sequel to Beer Fest, Pot Fest, and if we're going to do that, because we made that joke at the end of the movie.
Spin off about Rodé's character,
right?
Yeah. Well, he would. Oh, he's dead.
I'm dead. You can fucking kill me off.
It would be a prequel. We could do a prequel.
We never really see him die. It could be.
That's true.
He just has a wet poop chute.
I could come back with a colostomy bag and a chip on my shoulder.
Yeah.
And then something even worse could happen to me.
Right. It's the Pot Fest. Or, somebody shoves a bong up your ass.
Listen, we could. That's what it would be. They'd have to bring it back.
That's what's going to happen to me.
Someone would blow bong smoke up your ass.
Yeah. Awesome.
You know, we're not. We brought your dead twin brother back in Beer Fest. We could certainly bring. We're not afraid of twin brothers.
Yeah, we're not afraid of bringing people back. So. But no, that was the other one because, you know. At the end of that movie, we made the Potfest joke.
Right.
And it was a joke. And then all of a sudden, we started getting all these phone calls from people, like, who wanted to, not fans, but like people who were like Willie Nelson and Snoop Dogg and 50 Cent and Cheech and Chong. And they were like, are you guys going to make this movie? Because we'd be interested in getting involved. And we're like, oh, okay. So we started putting that together and making Potfest. But that's taking a back seat now.
Taking a back seat, but there is
the Super Trooper.
There's a pulse.
They're good. Pulse is good.
Yeah, I liked your character so much in Beer Fest. I'm not. It's like if I think about it. I mean, there's some. You know what I love about Beer Fest, and this is not a we're tooting our own
not
horn type
thing. Not a jerk yourself off moment.
It's not because I love all of the actors that came in and played the supporting roles.
Yeah,
like the guys who played the German brothers were fantastic. You were fantastic.
Yeah,
Monique was fantastic.
Donald Sutherland
was fantastic.
Yeah,
like to me that was our best movie in terms of the amount of pleasurable.
Yeah. But I think that was the key. Like that is because we had the money to do it for that. And then Slam and Salmon, which is probably what Gravy was like in the sense of like we were in L.A. And so you got – it's easier to get call people up and say, will you come do a day, please?
Absolutely.
And then they'll come and do it, you know?
Now, the thing that I regret about Slam and Salmon was being in Los Angeles though. And it's not a bad regret. It's more like it was the first time we had ever made a movie not on location. And for those people who don't know, on location just means you're someplace else on a location. And so that was the first time where we didn't – I felt we didn't have as much camaraderie with everybody because we were always going home at the end of the day.
And that may be true.
And when you were done, you were actually rushing to get home. You're like, I'm fucking out of here.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't. You were.
No, you weren't. I was.
But, I mean, yeah. Well, I mean, as a director...
But like when you're... like
there's stuff that outweighs that when you're a director making a movie in L.A. It's the ability... Your camera breaks... And you fucking need a new camera.
Sure.
Or whatever it is. The light blows. We need a new light. I mean, it's like...
Fair enough.
You have the infrastructure of the movie business at your fingertips.
But you could have that in Albuquerque where we shot.
No, you can't. You don't. You, and also the talent, the work pool. Like, you know, by the time you get to the you're making a $5 million movie. By the time you get down to the AC that fits your budget, you know, it's not as good as the guy you get now.
It is true. The very the very reason that people will come out and do those sweet favors for you is the exact same reason why you don't have that location type camaraderie.
Sure, but. If you're making a movie with Mike Weston in Los Angeles, chances are you aren't going to spend that much time together at the end of the day of shooting.
Well, that's right. But he's not going to get Sarah Silverman to come do it.
No, but what I mean is...
Absolutely,
you know,
true.
That kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, I guess everything has a pro and a con.
Everything has a pro and con, Mommy.
But working, obviously, I mean, half that cast are like some of my dearest friends.
Yeah.
Ethan Sandler, by the way, who I didn't mention. Do you guys know Ethan?
No, mm-hmm. I don't think so.
You guys should need to know Ethan. He's so funny. But like...
Is he thick?
He can.
Do you hang out with more thick? Like, do you not respect skinny people now? Do they have
he lifts
to be?
Weights? Is that why?
Well, because that does happen. It's like, you know, you want to sort of hang out with your own type, with your own food group.
No, okay. I've had the same group of friends for the better part of, you know, 15 years, and there's not a lot. I don't necessarily feel like there's a lot of seats left on the plane. Yeah, so.
I think you guys are a similar food group. I think both half Hispanic actors, writers. Come on.
Yeah.
But you know.
Let's do it, bro.
Let's absolutely do it. Okay. But I basically, half of that cast are my friends.
Sure.
And again, like, you take so much of the guesswork out of it when you when you surround yourself
with
people.
You can't pay to fly them if you're shooting in Vancouver.
Who you know
what I mean?
You know are going to come and bring it and give
absolutely.
It to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you especially, you know, when your budget and your timing is that tight, you got to make sure the person comes in and nails it.
And it was so dependent on cast, I didn't reinvent the wheel. It's a restaurant invasion comedy.
Yeah,
you know, we've seen it done 7 million different ways. What makes this one pop? What makes this one special?
Right, right.
The people in
Did you see the movie Chew?
Chew.
Was it Chew?
Oh, you mean Feast?
Feast.
Yeah,
that one.
Was that the Green? Which
the Project Greenlight?
Project Greenlight. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It happened with them. Yeah. They had creatures.
Yeah.
I don't have a supernatural element, but it's still.
I didn't watch the movie. I watched the Green Project.
I saw the movie on, it was on something at
some
point.
Oh, it was on cable or something?
Actually, you know, I can't remember if I liked it or not, honestly.
It's the cast, it's the people that did the movie and then what they did in the movie that I think raises the bar from what you expect from a film with that log line.
Yeah. Now, if Psych is done, is that what you want to do? You want to direct movies, or do you want to get back into TV somehow? What are you going to do, act and stuff?
The directing bug has bit me pretty hard and pretty deep.
And do you have projects that you are focusing on?
There are projects that I'm attached to, that I'm chasing, that I'm super interested in, that I have no shot of getting.
Yeah.
That is kind of where my head is
gravitating
at the moment.
Yeah. Will you direct more TV?
Maybe, you know,
just to keep honing your craft.
It's good to work the muscle. I mean, the TV is interesting because with Psych, because of my position in the show, like my cuts actually had a little bit, like there was some levity, like there was, they couldn't just toss them. Versus being a director for hire on a TV show, you're working the muscle, sure, but then you go in and you do this cut and you feel like, all right, I did a pretty good job with this. Those producers don't even have to watch your cut.
Yeah.
They can go in there and start with the editor's cut and do whatever they want.
Yeah.
So there is you have to know going in that it's no, and Jay could tell you this.
Yeah.
It's no longer about product, it's about process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, and getting paid, I guess.
Yes.
But you have to, and that's a tough thing to let go of if you're only used to doing your own stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you want to have some skin in the game.
And having control.
Yeah.
You're really just you're meat for hire.
Yeah.
And don't disrupt the flow. Don't make our show look different than it usually looks.
Yeah.
Make your days.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like, I don't know. Maybe if it's something really exotic, a show that I love or a show that shoots at a place that I probably never visit unless I go and direct an episode of the show.
Yeah.
Then I'm probably more apt to focus on you know more of my own stuff.
Yeah, and is Gravy a calling card that's allowing you to get that stuff, or is it more the Psych directing?
I sure hope so, man. I mean, because not a lot of people have seen Gravy.
Yeah,
it's sort of like a little thing that we're kind of judiciously choosing to hand out if it's really right for the job. It's not the calling card. It's not the kind of calling card that's going to get you hired for just. anything. It's a very specific piece of cinema.
Are you trying to do, I mean, you're talking about Skinwalkers and Gravy now. Are you trying to, are you a horror guy? Or
I've always been a horror guy.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like Soder. Soder's a big horror guy.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, I love comedy too. And, you know, one of my favorite movies ever is American Werewolf in London. And it's one of the few movies where I think the funny is funny and the scary is scary. And the two you don't have to compromise.
That's right.
You actually get both.
Yeah.
And that's a tough, very hard tightrope to walk.
Yeah, we tried that with Club Dread.
Yeah, we did. Well, that was, and that actually
some
was
of the funny was funny, and some of the scary was scary. But
yeah, I don't know how much of the scary was scary.
Yeah,
but like American Werewolf.
My mom was scared.
Okay. I mean, his nightmares, those dream sequences.
The double nightmare is one of the greatest scares, one of the greatest jumps I've ever had in a movie.
Double nightmare?
When he's
In American Werewolf.
Yeah, when the Nazi zombies show up and just assassinate his family.
Oh, God.
It's like there's some good shit.
So great.
I'd like to make those films.
Sure.
You know, Gravy was my shot. And then I think the reason that I fought so hard and stayed, you know, so myopic about getting Gravy made is because I wanted that to be the first thing.
Yeah.
I really did.
Yeah.
I wanted, like, this is my voice. This is what I do when I'm allowed to do whatever I want.
Yeah.
And it had to be that. And I think that's why I waited 8 years as opposed to, you know, taking a couple other opportunities that came along the way that would have, hey, I would have directed a movie sooner.
Sure.
But it wouldn't have been
yours.
The thing that I could say, okay, this is why maybe I have, you know, Maybe it's worth taking a look at me.
Yeah.
I actually have a voice. I have a point of view, and it's this. Yeah. It's not going to be for everybody, but for the people that it is for,
take it or leave it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Where are we? Kate.
Who do people tell you that you look like? Because I've got one.
Well, I'll tell you. I signed an autograph once for a couple of screaming girls who thought that I was. I was doing a production of Twelfth Night, and I had to dye my hair red because the girl, I was Sebastian, and the girl already had red hair.
Okay.
So I was like, fine. It's a lot harder for girls to do that.
Sure.
So I was like, I'll dye my hair red. I don't give a shit. Anyway, some girls ran up to me hyperventilating. Mm-hmm. This was, 2000 maybe, thinking that I was then-hit pop recording artist Jamie Walters.
Oh, okay. That how do you talk to an angel?
And they were so overjoyed.
Okay.
And so enthused.
I don't know who that is.
You do know. He was on that show, The Heights.
Okay. Yeah. That I did not have the heart to tell them that I wasn't their guy.
Okay.
And if they're out there listening, they're old enough, I think. It's like finding out that you're adopted. It's like they're old enough now, I think, will it be okay to know that the picture that, that wasn't me.
Yeah.
You have I signed Jamie Walters' name.
Yeah.
Who do you think he looks like?
I think he looks like Jason Giambi.
Ooh,
especially with
Jason Giambi,
especially with the thickness.
Wow,
Jason Giambi is way thicker than he is.
Yeah, well, pre-steroids,
steroids and post, and post.
Yeah, well, I don't mean the thick. I mean he's thick.
Baseball tip is nice though. Sticking with that though.
Yeah,
did you play baseball? Where in high school? Were you? You're a baseball player.
I stopped playing when high school started.
Okay,
I played Little League all growing up.
Katie's a San Francisco 49ers fan. What's your team?
I am a long-suffering Houston Oiler transplanted Tennessee Titans.
We're good friends with. We had a Mike Roos, offensive line of Tennessee
Titans,
on our podcast.
He was on the podcast.
I would have loved to have come.
It was great. We went down. We were doing shows down there, and he invited us out to the offensive line dinner of the Tennessee Titans.
I bet those guys can ring up a bill.
Dude. Oh man, holy shit!
It's like. It's exactly what you think it's going to be.
Wow.
You walk in, and it's a bunch of dudes at a table with, like, you see, like, four zebra legs sticking up in the air, and they're just going to fucking town. They eat so much fucking food, it's unbelievable.
They were great. But then they also have the quarterbacks, and the quarterbacks are there, so Jake Locker and Ryan Fitzpatrick.
Well, isn't it their job to pick up the bill?
No, it's they rotate, but it starts youngest guy or something like that. Like,
or rookies?
Rookies pick up the bill. I can't remember what it was, but it's like...
Quarterbacks should be picking up the bill for the O-line.
But I think the quarterbacks would be like, fuck it, I'm not going to even come then. Fuck you.
It's true. But, yeah, but the O-line guys, you know, they're not hurting for cash.
You got to take... Yeah, that's true. The guys in the trenches make the huge dollars, but you got to take care of the guys whose job it is to keep you from dying.
Sure. Yeah.
Sure. But Roos is making some dough.
Roos is making some dough.
Left tackle?
Have you gone to their games or anything like that? Or have you...
When they first moved to Tennessee, my best friend Todd and I, we went on a nice run for about 4 years where we would make it down there for a game every season. And we'd stay at this... was like a Days Inn that's directly across from LC or whatever the hell it's called now.
Yeah.
And you literally just wake up, walk across the street.
Yeah, we went this year.
See the, it's a good stadium. It's a fun town.
When we hang out with Roos, we should have Rodet come hang out too.
Yeah, absolutely.
You gotta.
Get him in with the Titans.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
Dude, it's fucking great. Like, they come to our shows, like the whole offensive line. It's the line and the quarterbacks.
Yeah.
And some kick returners.
Yeah, yeah, Mariano. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like we met the entire line.
You guys, that's my team.
I know. I know. I want to do it with my team.
I would totally like mark out and be silly.
Good.
The problem is there's a drawback. Is like they party, and so like, and they're like, come on, you know, we're gonna go drink for drink, and you're not gonna back down,
right?
Because these are the ultimate men who are like, are you a man?
Yeah.
And so you do it, and you can't. It's not possible.
I've had that experience with the WWE guys.
Okay. Oh, right. You guys do a lot of
crossover with our show. And it's the same thing. They come out, and it's almost like they feel – they hear what the last guy did.
Yeah.
Because Cena kicked it off.
Yeah.
He was the first one.
Yeah.
And he's a jack guy.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember a lot about that.
Right.
He's apparently a big fan of ours.
Is he? Yeah. Oh, Chandler Sager's
hanging. He did. Yeah. He said that when he came up to the show.
Okay.
And then the next guy, you know, was The Miz, and he had heard what, you know, Cena had done.
And then he took you out drinking.
Yes. And then Big Show came up, and he'd heard.
Oh, my God.
So it's almost like
huge.
A competition among – and yeah, and exactly. You're going to go drink for drink
with that guy?
The Big Show?
Well, that's what Lemmy does. Lemmy every time says to Mike Roos or one of those guys, I'm going to go drink for drink with you, and then he gets fucking crushed.
Yeah, we'll get destroyed.
They bury me.
I get buried. Mm. Yeah, totally. But you know going in you're going to get destroyed. And if you can get into the right frame of mind, it's just like, you know. It's like going to Vegas, and you know you're going to lose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But just enjoy the ride.
Just enjoy the ride. Yeah. I'm going to get annihilated.
Yeah. Well, all right. Should we wrap it up?
Yeah. We got to wrap.
Will you eat something for us? Will you chew something for us?
Oh. It's something involved. Oh, wait. He's cleaning his teeth. Something got stuck in his teeth.
Yeah, like a pulled pork type thing. Or?
I was going for cocaine. Did that not read?
I don't think we've had anyone ever chew cocaine on our show.
I was trying to chew crack cocaine for you guys.
Okay, no one has ever done that before.
That was excellent.
That's why I did the teeth thing.
Yeah, that's great.
And the
Holy
snort,
shit, that's
too.
Fucking great. Psych, new season.
New season, we're on
started.
We're on Wednesdays. This could be it, who knows? So, you know.
So get it in now.
Smoke while you got them, yeah.
Yeah, do it.
Red Dog Squadron, let's get some local Los Angeles love for that.
When
theater
opens, the Circle Theater.
What's the target date?
Let you guys know. Hopefully summer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And look for gravy. Everybody look for gravy.
Look for gravy, man.
Yeah. And chew it.
Yeah. I'm gonna chew some gravy.
Yeah, eat some gravy.
Slurp it. Get it.
Ooh, no lumps.
Good. Thanks, Rodé.
Thank you, guys.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.